Like $3 million in revenue for a company is like a hard thing to do. It's also very difficult to get a company that has a valuation of $7 billion. I think it might be unprecedented that both of those things happen with the same company.
This podcast contains the arguably witty banter of two friends, Skippy and Doodles, that like to debate about investing. The content is intended to be entertaining and for informational purposes only, not investment advice. You should do your own research and consult a financial professional before using any of the information in this podcast, and especially before investing.
There he is, the man, the myth, the legend, Skippity Doodah.
You survived. I mean, I don't know why. When I go over the Atlantic, it's like feels like no big deal. When I go over the Pacific and I make it back across that international dateline and everything, I always feel like I survived.
George Washington in his rowboat going across the Pacific.
Quite,
remember that painting?
Not like that at all, actually. No.
Oh, because he was on a river in DC.
And like, yeah, and I like fly on a plane, but
I take air blimp.
You know, former President Trump, his plane is looking a little raggedy to me. Like it looks a little dated when I see it. Do you think that thing is equipped to fly over the Pacific? I'm not sure.
It was looking ragged.
Not
it
anymore.
Was looking ragged. I mean, I don't know. Should we get into DJT?
I mean, you
I think
a
we have
background.
To. I think
for
we have to. Okay.
Don't know.
All right. This has been a 2 year, I think, probably not quite, but about 2 year adventure, give or take. Maybe you can check the dates here, where you had Truth Social that came out. If y'all might recall, there was a point where former President Donald John Trump, DJT, he was banned from Twitter for spreading misinformation. That was the ban that came. You're spreading misinformation. Could be harmful, banned from Twitter. So he said, well, Twitter, you suck anyway. I'm going to start my own platform. Started Truth Social. So this is bringing the truth through social media. Truth Social, just a little background on the name. The, what is it, epistemology, whatever the name giant says. So started Truth Social. He actually has this, I don't know the exact like contractor terms, but it's something where he can only create posts on True Social unless they are political, which is every post.
Oh, really?
That
That's
he
like
posts.
Official? Okay.
It's something like that. That's how he gets his earns his keep. So he owns something like 60% of the holding company for True Social, which is Trump Media and Technology Group. Okay, so that's a little bit of background. Now, the 2 year journey that I'm talking about is, remember the SPAC craze? Everybody remembers the SPAC craze. And there was a SPAC that was Digital World, or still is maybe, Digital World Acquisition Corp. I don't know if it sticks around after the acquisition, but regardless, yeah. There's a SPAC. The SPAC traded up and down because the SPAC, it was set to buy Trump Media and Technology Group, but the deal wasn't completely firmed. Like it never really went through until now. I'm gonna call all these coincidences. Y'all can take for use your own brain cells to figure out if you think it's coincidence. But what happened is Trump owes about $500 million that he cannot come up with because lenders won't lend to him. And that kind of cash just laying around doesn't even happen with billionaires. He owes about $500 million. Next thing you know, oh, the deal goes through for this company to now be acquired by Digital World Acquisition Corp. That's back. So DJT gets publicly traded at a pretty fair valuation.
What?
I mean, it depends on you know, what your valuation metrics are. But
all right, this is a whole new there will be laws on top of laws on top of laws about, so props to the former president, because this is incredible. This is there is some thought that there is nefarious foreign actors involved in inflating the valuation of this company in order to finance money to the former president for his causes. Like, I think that's all gray logic at this point, but no one really thought in the 1800s or the 1700s about, you know what, if I create a company that makes almost no money and then find the right people, find a way to trade that stock publicly and inflate the value. Let's talk about the value a little bit. In the history of Truth Social, they have brought in $5 million in revenue over the course of multiple years. I'm not a venture guy, but Jason, is it Calacanis? How can I remember?
Calacanis or something like that, but yeah.
Yeah, all right. He is a venture guy. He says, based on what he sees in the market, if they did seed, or if you were doing a Series A with $3 million in yearly revenue, which is what Truth Social is doing, it would be worth roughly 20 to 50 times top line revenue at the absolute max, even if it's 3x in revenue every year. So he anticipates the maximum this thing is worth is $150 million. Douglas, how about you tell us the current market cap?
$7 billion.
$7 billion. Are those numbers different?
Different than what? 150 and 7? So well, yes, 150 is different
your units
than 7.
Right, first of all.
And M is different than B. Yes, these are different. It's so rare. We're gonna get back to the fundraising via publicly traded company point in a second. Okay. It's not common. I shouldn't say very rare, but it's not common and it's hard to do to build a company that makes $3 million a year. Like $3 million in revenue for a company is like a hard thing to do. It's also very difficult to get a company that has a valuation of $7 billion. I think it might be unprecedented that both of those things happen with the same company.
Yes, I can't recall a time. We make fun of some of your ratios here. Like the price to sales on this thing. Well, let's just call it infinity. All right. Like,
yeah. Because here, this is from, there's a Wall Street Journal piece about this. And this quote, I just love. It's a quote from a poster, I think, or like advertisement about the stock. The quote is this: I just bought more shares because of reasons. I had to read that line so many times. I went, there has to be something I'm missing in this. I just bought more shares because of reasons. Just sit with that.
So our boy, my boy at least, James McIntosh, wrote two pieces on this week. And James has been on the show. We love him. He is such a well-researched and analytical mind, right? His first article from March 28th is, Dear Donald Trump, here's how to manage your stock market fortune. And he walks him through like step by step how irrational it is and how he should like basically sell as soon as possible, but he doesn't really expect him to be able to sell. Douglas, we're getting to a conversation that I have with my 10 and 11 year old all the time, which is like, oh, well, so what is paper wealth? And can you actually turn that into real wealth? Like, if he tries to sell this thing, one, think of the PR hit that takes, because it's a blank check company, effectively, supported by people that aren't investing on fundamentals, that is actually worth basically $0. So if you try and sell a billion of it, one, there's not liquidity to support that sale. Yep. Two, it's a straight up Ponzi scheme. You might argue with me on that, but you're just hoping you can pass the check to the next sucker that doesn't understand that they aren't investing in anything. They're investing in an idea.
Yeah, it is. It goes back to, now let's step back. It goes back to the point you brought up around laws that are probably going to pop up around this type of thing, because I'm not saying that this is intentional, because I don't know, but read between the lines. If you say that there are laws, and then probably not enough, but there are laws that are, whatever you want to call it, protective, prohibitive, however you want to define it, around raising money for political campaigns, like there are some guardrails, again, mm-hmm. probably not enough. Mm-hmm. So let's just create a shell company that people can invest in so that I can get the money from that. I'm not sure anyone's ever thought about that. I don't remember Clinton LLC going public. I don't remember Polk Incorporated. This is very interesting. And I suspect the board's got to vote on whether or not he can sell shares. And going back to your McIntosh point, I don't know the article in front of me, but it was something like he could take out a loan against the collateral. He could sell. There's like a few potential options.
I mean, I actually misspoke. James ultimately ends up recommending that he borrow against the shares because he can do that without raising a red flag. And he compares this to what Ryan Cohen did with Bed Bath & Beyond. And when he bought and when he sold, and the stock, he when he sold, the stock effectively goes to zero. That's the same thing that will happen here because the backstop, the fundamentals do not exist. So this thing is going to zero. It's just a matter of how long. He's currently in a holding period where he can't even sell. And then, yeah, I mean, McIntosh made this point too. The board's like his son's Dougal's. So the board's going to allow him to do whatever he wants. Fascinating, though. I mean, in one way, props. Very creative. Very, very creative.
The other way, this is, we're talking bizarro world at this point because this is such an outlier. The other way is, if you remember back in, you do, because this was just a few years ago. Remember when Bloomberg was willing to spend whatever it took in order for Trump to lose 4 years ago? And he ended up spending like $1 billion or $2 billion of his own dollars or something like that.
Bucks.
Yeah, something like that. If someone was on the other side of that, that just said, you know what? I'm actually just going to buy DJT. I'm going to buy it for $3 billion, the whole thing.
Here's, I don't like to talk politics on the show because that's not what the show's about. Yeah. And I don't really like to talk things that I can't like that are fuzzy logic and maybe gray area. But there is definitely speculation that some of the money propping up this valuation might have ulterior motives, right?
Yeah.
And to your point, so I think that's already happening. Now, the question is, will that continue to happen? Meaning, will they be willing to buy shares 6 months from now and buy shares directly from Donald Trump to put money into his pocket? I don't know, but it's fascinating.
Well, he doesn't have 6 months, though. Like, it's something has to happen with him being able to get cash in the next couple months, max.
Very true, but he can't sell, and I don't. So,
I know, but I'm just saying, like, that's the something has to happen with this, actually, with the quicks, because if this money is going to, this is having the conversation from even an investing perspective, just like the reality of the markets in investing. If someone needs cash now for two reasons, one is because of money that's owed for regulatory purposes, and the other is for campaigning. Both those things need to happen ahora.
Yes, but if I'm Zuckerberg and I walk into Bank of America and say, hey, you want a loan against my Facebook shares? They go, cool.
That's fair.
Yeah, how much do you want?
That's
and if I'm not Zuckerberg and I own some DJT stock and I walk into Bank of America, do you think they laugh? I mean,
they do.
If the bankers know how to do math, they laugh.
Because they'll go, do you have any Dogecoin? Because maybe then.
All right, let's move on. So you and I mean, sometimes we argue on the show, for sure. Sometimes we argue in real life. We had like a text fight argument here this week. I think while you were on the other side of the Pacific Ocean. Maybe not. You want to fill the people in on your insane take here. And
okay, so now you're already throwing out bias. So was it 2 weeks ago, 2 or 3 weeks ago, we discussed the top rated or highest reviewed investing books. Mm-hmm. And there were a couple of them that we hadn't read yet. Mm-hmm. Me having more unreads than you. And we started reading them. One of those is A Simple Path to Wealth. So we both read it.
Yep. Well, no, I made it halfway through.
Oh, see, you didn't even, the ending is where it all comes together.
Well, I mean, no, if you
I'm
tell
joking.
Me that.
I'm joking. I'm joking. Okay. No. So A Simple Path to Wealth. And I'd say, so there's this book in summary. I'll give it like a 2-sentence summary and then you can add color if you'd like. But one, the author here is saying save a whole bunch of money. He was saving half of his income at one point. Mm-hmm. The other part of that is the stuff that you save, put it into U.S. equities.
Mm-hmm.
That's the simple path to wealth. A lot of other detail that sits in the book, but I'm going to summarize it that way. You took issue with both of those points.
Okay. So one, take a deep breath. All right. First and foremost, the foreword is written by Mr. Money Mustache. I was like, cool, this is great. Mr. Money Mustache is awesome. He's He's local. I love his stuff. He's sane. This is awesome. The book is, it tries hard. It speaks in absolutes. The first absolute is the U.S. stock market will always make money and always rebound. And you can mindlessly put money into the U.S. stock market and you will be just fine. Okay? What we've talked about this so much. What happened to the Czech Republic? What happened to Argentina? What happened to Japan? Almost every stock market in the world has not always rebounded. This blindless, you can put money here without any thought of valuation or government debt or anything else. Like, the U.S. stock market is great. Someone like Warren Buffett currently will still tell you that when he dies, he wants 90% of his money in U.S. stocks and 10% in bonds. Okay? But to say that that advice is always true and never requires any thought is absolutely bad advice, in my opinion. Because, well, there's a whole other rant there, but I think I'll keep it at that for now. The other thing that he... let me be positive. I like the way he talks about debt, okay? He does a really good job of talking about the miracles of compound interest and how if you're on the reverse side of that, meaning you have lots of debt, that's going to hurt you long term. His strategies to talk about paying down debt, I think, are really solid. It is the opposite of the Ramsey approach, where he says, we're going to actually do math and save you money when you pay off debt, which I think is great. You know, like, I understand the Ramsey approach to get that debt waterfall, pay off your smallest debt first because of the psychological benefits. I don't have a problem with that either. I think the book comes from a good place, but this is an individual that has always saved 50% of their wealth. And then it comes across in a like luxury tone with all these absolutes. I just think I literally on my bookshelf right here have five other books that do the same thing, have the same intent, and actually deliver the message in a way that is consumable, digestible, and can lead you forward. The reason this book is so well reviewed is because it is a book that made its circles in the FIRE movement, and those people have mindlessly said, and I'm not talking trash, there's some benefits to that, but those people have mindlessly said this is a 5-star book. If you have read 20 to 30 or to more personal finance books like I have, there is no possible way, and to have a brain, there is no possible way this book should be number 2 on the list. This book should be number 50 on the list at best.
Wow. You talking about don't say absolutes, and then you came out with an absolute there, did you not? So I have some areas of agreement with what you're talking about. I think the FIRE movement, save half your income, is unrealistic for most people, whether that's logistically, financially, or behaviorally. I think there's a number of factors that can make that unrealistic to folks. Let's put that aside.
Yeah.
The mindless, blindless, blindful, I don't know, but the mindless aspect of this, I think that when you're taking the average investor who may not know as much, that it is not necessarily a bad thing to say, do this simple thing.
Agreed. I completely agree. You know what else is really simple? Open up a Wealthfront account, do 80% diversified equities and 20% diversified bonds. You can buy the total world stock market index. You can buy, like, there's so many ways to do this simply. And I recommend that all the time. With Wealthfront or Betterment, or there's these brilliant apps out there, you can open an account, not even, like, say my risk tolerance is a 7, not even pick your stocks and have diversification that you can mindlessly put $100 a week in and become a millionaire in no time. There are so many great ways to do this. And the other book, I don't want to detour us from this, but the other book that we both read, I think, is The Barefoot Investor, which is the most popular Australian book of all time, which this guy is quirky, and I don't think all of his advice is perfect, but that book was 10 times better, Stugals. Did you read it?
Yeah. They're different. They're different books. Yeah.
They're personal finance books about how to accomplish your wealth, like a strategy to accomplish your wealth. So they're not that different. One is much more similar.
No. Well, it depends. So here's the way I put it. I put A Simple Path to Wealth in the investing book category. Okay. And Barefoot Investor closer to the personal finance category. There certainly overlaps in those two. But what I see A Simple Path to Wealth doing is saying, look, if you invest in US equities, more power to you, always up and to the right. Like that last part, I agree with your point that just saying that to someone with a straight face, you really shouldn't do with absolutes. But that's the point. It's like about investing. Now, how do you get that money to invest? No minimal to no debt and save a whole lot of your income. Like that's the book, but it's about wealth investing. The Barefoot Investor, which I do think the book was better. Like I completely agree with it. I think the book's better. That one is so much more tactical. This is how do you call your credit card company and what's the script that you tell them in order to save money? Like that's personal finance, like to the extreme with scripts. Like it is a tactical book.
But the Barefoot Investor is pretty awesome in the sense of, I'm going to simplify here, but you kind of have 70% of your money going to pay like necessity like stuff and fun stuff. And then you have these other buckets, but largely there's this other 20% carve out that he calls your fire extinguisher. And it's like you have 20% of your income that is going to whatever you need. That might be your kids are getting married and you have to pay for a wedding. It might be you have debt and you have to pay down that debt. It might be you have a mortgage and you're trying to pay off that mortgage. Is also like it was doable. It was not save 50, live on 50% of your income, move to rural. And I'm not saying The Simple Path to Wealth says this exactly, but he says what I did is I moved to rural New Hampshire, I think.
Yeah.
And I've never lived on more than 50% of my income and I've always invested like 50% of my income effectively. Like, that is not realistic for your average person in America who lives well beyond their means, has credit card debt and everything else. Like the whole thing with The Simple Path to Wealth is it's so rigid and so stark and so different from your average American. It doesn't even feel attainable. And then I think we'll get into the 100% equities piece, which I have a huge issue with on the volatility front. Because we're talking about your average investor.
Yeah. The reason, so let's talk 100% equities. The reason that not individually picked stocks, but let's take an index fund, S&P 500, like a SPY or something like VTI, which I'm keeping that because that's US only, because I know the part of what your argument is going to be to spread it out. The thing that I like about that is, and this mixes in with his absolutes point, which I do agree with your broad point on the absolutes. I get that. But the reason I like it in this context is because when it's not absolute, behaviorally, I believe that it's easier for people to say, okay, well, this isn't always true. Like, it's not always true that it's going to go up. And so therefore, if it goes down, I'm more likely then to sell. Whereas if you say your mindset going into this is buy and hold for the long term, it will come back. Even if that mindset's incorrect, I think that's when you keep it that simple, put the money in SPY, the thing's always just going to come back, just keep putting it, then behaviorally, it can possibly psychologically like cut out a lot of the behavioral issues that come along with it. That's why I don't think it's as bad as what you are putting out there.
Yeah. And, you know, the perfect time to write this book would be in Japan in 1987, because the Japanese stock market was the hottest stock market in the world. And well, really 1988. So, and the Japanese stock market had always rebounded. And we talked about the Japanese broker a few months back having parties. Like all the brokers had to think about was how to have a bigger party each year, because the stock market printed money and it was never going down. Then 35 years disappeared.
Yeah. But if you take the Japanese stock market, over no 35-year period has ever been negative.
and it always comes back. And you don't think that the investor psychology that happened when we talked about this too. We talked about his son being like, I actually don't know how to celebrate the euphoria that's happening in the Japanese yeah. stock market in 2024 yeah. because my generation has never seen this. People from that generation are going to pick up this book, The Simple Path to Wealth, and read always the U.S. stock
it's insulting.
Always comes back.
It's insulting.
I mean, people are going to burn that book because there's no nuance about, well, you know what? Valuations actually matter. And the U.S. stock market has had incredible performance. Even so, like if that someone picked up that book in 1944, right? I know the book wasn't written, but and they were reading always, and you're in the middle of World War II and you're coming out of the Great Depression, and it's just like this no-brainer. I can mindlessly put money into the U.S. stock market. No, the psyche of that generation does not work. I just think, okay, but let's talk specifically 100% equities. Douglas, why would you want to invest in 100% equities?
People looking historically and extrapolating that, which is always dangerous, but equities over the long term in the United States have rebounded and have outperformed. And it's an easier to understand thing.
Outperformed what? Outperformed bonds and cash, right? Those are the three.
And real estate.
And real estate. Okay, great. So what's the downside of that? Increased volatility, right?
If you pay attention to it, yeah.
Okay.
Or if you're close to retirement, like if you need the cash, like there's, you know, there are other nuances.
So I argue anyone that is comfortable with 100% equity strategy is kind of in finance nerd land. They've done the math and they've said, this is the greatest risk return reward that is simple, right?
Yep.
So I'm going to send you over to AQR and say, let's do a little more math. You're going to hate this, but let's
And you're not going to keep simplicity, I'm assuming.
I'm not going to keep simplicity at all. I'm going to say you want the maximum risk adjusted return, don't you? That's the reason to hold 100% equities. You don't want safety. Like safety is out the window when you're talking about, I want the riskiest but best performing asset.
And simplest.
That's just how I think of it. Well, okay. We're going to disagree on the simplest point.
Yep.
Tons of back testing. There are mutual fund products in the market today that are very simple to buy. That take, it's called a levered 60-40 portfolio. And basically what they do is they use futures contracts to get leverage. So your true holding is about 155%, meaning almost 90% equities and 60% bonds. And guess what? That outperforms 100% equities with the same volatility.
You won't because you're going to write a book called A Simple Path to Wealth and start it with futures contracts.
No, that's why this is so insane, because if you want the best risk adjusted return, you should do futures contracts, but futures contracts are insane for your average investor. So why would you do something that gets you a worse return that has the same volatility? Okay. Why would you do it?
I'm going to transition us right now. And I want to talk about the actual simplest path. You're going to bring us back?
Well, let me do one thing. I have two books. I got them down from my shelf just so Douglas can verify. If you want to read personal finance books, my top two are The Wealthy Barber right here and Simple Wealth, Inevitable Wealth. These books will knock your socks off. These books are incredible. Even The Barefoot Investor is good. Do not read this James L. Collins nonsense. Do not do it. It's bad for your health.
All right. Now I'm transitioning back into the fishbowl. The real simplest path to wealth. Someone wrote this tweet, which you could tear this tweet apart in a million different ways, and it probably should be. But if you graduated in 2013 and got a job at NVIDIA, NVIDIA gave you those options, and those options... This number just comes from simple math he was trying to do to get $200 million. Those options were worth $400,000 vesting over 4 years. They would now be worth $100 million a decade into your career. This is not the only stock that has done something like this, but it's wild just to think about the idea of something going 250x in a decade. And so if you read the Twitter thread, people go into what new graduate is getting $400,000 in options, right? As an example.
Yeah.
You could divide that, choose your number by 10. Still pretty solid. Like over,
I mean, a software engineer could easily get 400K in options.
Today. I don't know if they would get that a decade ago in NVIDIA.
Yeah, but no, Douglas, you missed the piece. And now you're retired and you're a guru on Instagram selling your courses on how to turn, how to become a 100 millionaire. It's just this simple. Like,
yeah,
that's the thing. So your example to me clearly articulates that a fair amount of wealth creation, especially the explosive kind, is luck. I'm not claiming the person wasn't smart, but odds are they grew up in California, went to a California university that was near the NVIDIA campus, and picked a major that happened to be in demand at the time that for NVIDIA in 2013.
Probably.
Awesome. Props to you. But I just see those things conflated so much in the world today that says, you know,
yep.
Chamath happened to be at Facebook at the right time, so now we should listen to what Chamath has to say. Not for me.
Yeah, chapter one of the book, or the course, is when choosing your parents, choose these types of parents. When choosing your place of birth.
When choosing the country you're born. Yeah, when choosing the state you grow up in. There you go. Perfect.
Yeah, no, I hear that. It is a lot of luck that goes into something like this. And to your point, it doesn't take away, we're not saying it's only luck. It doesn't take away that the person was smart or that they were hardworking or any, like, you don't take away any of that stuff. It's just that when you look at those attributes, the population that satisfies hardworking and smart is a lot larger than the population that gets the whatever 8-9 figure payout.
Yeah.
And the difference there is often some semblance of luck or compounding luck.
Well, it's almost always compounding luck. And don't forget the people that are lazy and dumb who get the 9-figure payout. Because that happens too.
It's not a perfect Venn diagram. Yeah.
Do I sound like I'm doing nothing but throwing shade today? That's not the intent. Okay, let's talk. I don't think this is, well, you tell me. I'm not sure how much luck is involved here. Do you know that Michael Saylor is selling his own stock?
Go on. Just go on.
So Michael Saylor is the world's biggest Bitcoin fan. We've talked about it about the show for years. He was taking all the debt he could get to buy Bitcoin. And I'll give him credit. His conviction is strong. So that he almost got margin called back when Bitcoin went through its mini winter here, and now he's back on top. So what's happened with his company, MicroStrategy, is before there was a Bitcoin ETF available, effectively people would buy MicroStrategy to get exposure to Bitcoin because his company held a bunch of Bitcoin. Well, the markets have gone kind of crazy, which happens all the time in this space. And the net asset value of his company is now worth about half of what it should be worth based on the current price of Bitcoin. So Michael can't sit on his hands. It's impossible for him. So he started selling his own company's stock to generate dollars to buy more Bitcoin outside of his company because of the disconnect between his company's stock price and the net asset value.
How do you find yourself here? Like when Michael Saylor, because he founded or co-founded MicroStrategy, yeah, back in the 1990s.
And it was a very successful and profitable company. It just
analytics. It's an analytics, yeah, company. Yeah. I used to use their software. There was, mm-hmm, no Bitcoin in that software. Yeah, I don't know how you find yourself here. But yeah, that is fascinating. So you view that as a short?
Not really. I mean, the math checks out. It's a smart play. His entire goal in life, like, I'm not sure if he talks to people. I think all he does is stare at a computer screen and figure out how to buy more Bitcoin. And listen, right now that looks like a good transfer. Props to him. But man, I don't, from afar, it just seems like there's no enjoyment in his current wealth. And is that the point? I don't know. I don't know what drives him, but it's weird, right? If any other CEO was selling their own stock, to buy another asset that's not their stock, I think it'd make headlines. And I don't think anyone cares about Michael Saylor anymore.
Well, I mean, we obviously do.
Sorry, I didn't mean it like that. I for some reason, this is not front page news.
Yeah. It's not quite the hype that it was 18 months ago or even a year ago. Yeah, I completely agree. Can I transition us again?
Yeah.
Okay. I want to ride the point around enjoyment that you brought up and reach into the fishbowl to talk about this interview between Robert Armstrong and Oswath Damodaran. I don't know how you pronounce his name, but he's our boy from NYU, valuation expert for the Stars. Is that, I don't know, is that a thing? Valuation expert for the Stars? But that's what he is. So there's this interview with him. One of the points that he brought up, which is why I thought about this following that, is that he said, if I'm in my 80s and my time is coming to an end, and you were talking to me and you said through all your work and like analysis of valuations and stock buying and all that, all you did was match an index fund, how would you feel about it? He goes, I would feel perfectly fine because I enjoy the process. And he said, some people, it's all about the overperformance and there's no enjoyment. I don't understand that because it's so hard to outperform the market that you might as well just buy an index fund if you don't enjoy the process, because the process is so tedious and et cetera, if you don't enjoy it. I love that point. So when you brought up the Michael Saylor, like, does he even enjoy this anymore? I don't know.
That's an awesome point. I've had the same conversation with myself, for sure. And I love his take.
Yeah. I'm way too competitive to say that I would be okay with that. But I also do really enjoy the process. It's when, you know, you brought up this point, which I think is a good one. I can't remember who, was it Meb Faber, someone that raised the idea of how much time are you spending on investing and isn't it worth your amount of time? Mm-hmm. The reason why I dismiss that is because of how much I enjoy it. Like the process of it. But
well, no, here's the other thing is I have outperformed. I fully expect to continue to outperform over long periods of time.
Yeah.
But you can have a quality process and get unlucky, right?
Yeah.
So you better enjoy it. I just think it's right.
Yeah.
Would I be doing this if I expected to underperform long term? I don't know, but maybe.
I wouldn't do it to the same degree. I think the proportion of money that was in my model portfolio would be different if I expected it, but I'd still have it. I'd probably still have it because I enjoyed it, but it would probably be the inverse of what it exists like today. So that's one point I enjoyed through this piece. Another one that I liked is he's talking about the market today. And the question was, where's the market valued as of today? This interview was in the last couple of weeks, so picture current valuations of the U.S. stock market. He says, I'm going to say something that's going to sound weird. A market with a T-bond rate of 4% is much healthier than a market with a T-bond rate of 1.5%. People don't feel the urge to do stupid things.
It's not weird at all. It's right on.
It's right on. But it is weird. When he goes on, he talks about something we've discussed here a bit. It's weird because of all the conversation and narrative right now that is waiting for the Fed to cut rates. And he's like, we are just in a place where it's healthy. So much chatter about waiting to cut rates from a place that is healthy to a place that is unhealthy is ridiculous.
Yeah.
All right. The last point.
We're addicted. I mean, the financial markets are addicted to the drug overdose that happened the last decade. It's natural to be I really feel like your average real estate investor, and sorry, I'm not trying to pick on everyone, but they're an easy target, is like, no, do you know how much easier it was in 2007? Please, can we go back? Like, my business model doesn't work anymore. And then there's other folks like me and you that are like, this is awesome. I mean, I still want rates to increase, but.
Yeah,
I'm insane.
It is absolutely phenomenal, because going back to the Tina point, there is no alternative that existed just a couple years ago. Now, when there's money sitting on the sidelines, that money is generating income. Mm-hmm. 5%+.
Yep.
That's great. When that money was generating 0.01%, you know, whatever the rate was, it wasn't quite that bad. But when the money was generating basically nothing, that's a whole different world. And to his point, people don't feel the urge to do stupid things, because if the money's doing something, you're not like, okay, I got to figure out some way to deploy this. And action is all in the investing world and other places in life, but human behavior in the investing world, the bias is toward doing a thing, even if doing a thing is not in your best interest. Mm-hmm. All right, I got one more thing to raise from this. Going back to NVIDIA, going back for a second, he owns this stock. This is a person that looks at valuations. So what he said was the question was around what his thinking around NVIDIA. He said, so at 450, when NVIDIA was at 450, which is, you know, when we were talking about it, whatever that was, 9 months ago, a year or something ago.
Yeah.
We were talking about NVIDIA at 450. And he goes, when I looked at it then, it was a bit overvalued. So I'd sold half my stake. And the guy said, so now that it's at 850, have you sold half your stake again? He goes, yeah. He said, I have a quarter of the stake in NVIDIA that I had before, and I actually don't care. I'm good with that. I bought NVIDIA at $27. Like, I'm good. And just being able to have that mindset, because it's not opportunity cost that I'm thinking of, but it's not loss aversion. I'm trying to think of like what the right FOMO, I guess, is probably maybe the right term. Mm-hmm. Where if someone sells half at 450, then it goes to 850, human behavior can actually be like, oh, you know, what did I leave on the table? And he's saying, I don't want to be overly greedy with this thing. I'm trying to be smart based on the valuations that I have.
I love this. There's a great lesson here. I mean, so I did something similar with Meta, where it got to a price that I felt was clearly overvalued, but I still can make a theoretical case for upside long-term, like over a 20-year period, right?
Yep.
And so when you take half off the table and there's been a quality return, one, you pay yourself back, so it becomes almost a risk-free holding for you. Yep. And then you manage the FOMO. Like, I think he actually did this perfectly. I was never a stockholder, but to sell half at 450 is perfect, and perfect timing. And then to sell another half at 850 is great. And now that quarter, if NVIDIA goes to $5,000 a share, he still makes tons and tons and tons of money. But if it does what it's more likely to do, which is pull back, there's no sweat. Like, brilliant management of investor psychology. And this is where I'd go back and throw some more shade at The Simple Path to Wealth. This is how people's minds work, right? When the U.S. stock market goes down 50% and you have all your holdings, and the only reason, and you read the Wall Street Journal, and the only reason you think that all your holdings should be in 100% U.S. stocks is because some random dude wrote always in a book. You're not set up for success.
I just pictured you waking up in the middle of the night, sweat dripping down you. Nightmare just happened. And it was because you were forced to, you have to buy and hold for 5 years. And you only have two options, NVIDIA or DJT. I don't even know what you would do with yourself.
Jumping off something at that point.
Cool. All right. That's all I got.
Perfect. Thanks, guys. Sorry we missed last week, but glad we were able to get a little travel in for Dougals. We will be in touch here shortly. All thanks for the show are skippydougals.com. We offer premium subscriptions to support the show and get stock picks if you want. Also get other benefits like getting the show early. That's at skippydougals.supercast.com. Please share the show with a friend and shoot it a review our way. We appreciate those, and it helps more people find the show.
Thank you.